Welcome to Theatre Audience Podcast. I'm Natalie, joined by Darren, and we bring you the news, reviews and recommendations of the latest theatre.
We'll be discussing what's on, what's been and gone, and the next hot ticks.
Hello, I'm Tom Ratcliffe, and you're listening to Theatre Audience Podcast.
Good evening, Natalie.
Hi, Darren. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Very well. Had a busy week. How was your week?
Oh, my goodness. Absolutely exhausted. I've had A-level performances. I've been off examining A-level performances. And I had the culmination of the performance of my course where I did 10 minutes of stand-up. Can you believe it?
Oh, well done you. Have you seen the, the Fabulous Miss Maisel?
No, what's that?
It's a TV show. It's about kind of a stand-up comic. She kind of falls into it by accident being drunk in a bar. But you'd have to watch it, actually, because it's really fun. It's set in the 1950s, I believe. Yeah, in New York. It's about a woman that ends up being a stand-up comic. And she's actually quite funny. Are you funny?
Interesting. Well, let's just say there was lots of laughs in that room. It was rip-roaring comedy.
Were they laughing with you or at you?
They were laughing with me because they had to. I became quite a bossy character, actually.
Wow.
Yeah.
Watch this space. So you have your own stand-up comic podcast soon then, yeah?
She was quite aggressive, actually, Mr. Mina.
Oh, dear. Well, what are we going to talk about this week? We're going to be talking about Standing at the Sky's Edge, because we both saw that one, which is good.
Yes.
You're going to be talking about...
For Black Boys Who Have Considered Suicide When the Hue Gets Too Heavy, which was fantastic.
And was it...
Yeah.
Was it heavy?
Do you know what? It was... Oh, well, I'm going to review it. There was so much. There was the juxtaposition between the really heavy emotional stuff and just the witty humour. It was so incredibly clever.
That's good. It sounds good. Would I like it?
Yes. Such a big pause there. Well, that's good. You were just taking that all on board, right?
I was, definitely. But I'm looking forward to hearing what you have to say about it, that's for sure.
Yeah, and there's an interview at the end of this one as well. Who did you go and speak to?
I spoke to Barry McStay, who's written a wonderful play, or at least I hope it's wonderful, I've yet to see it, called Breeding, which is opening at the King's Head Theatre. It did a short spurt last year, and this year it's been taken over by Tom Ratcliffe, who actually programmed it as part of his season at the King's Head Theatre last year and is now directing it himself this time round. So that opens very soon, which I'm actually really looking forward to. And so, yeah, I had a good old chat with the guys, kind of behind the scenes at the rehearsal space in a cupboard. So it was three gays back in a closet.
Is that because it was the only quiet place backstage? I tell you what, we have done some interviews in some really interesting places recently. I remember, was it Coming Clean, your show?
That the telephone
was
box.
Upstage at the, yeah, and then I ended up after the after party doing an interview in the telephone box, and then I think it was about 3 a.m. as well, and then you could hear all the bottles being taken away from the village and all the other bars around there. It was hilarious. You've been in the closet
a few times,
and then out the closet. Witness for the prosecution, I was in the room where they have their little kip between shows, attaching my microphone to some kind of dummy's head, and then the other day at the Old Vic, I was in the bathrooms with Tamara Terre having the Just For One Day interview. So, yeah, we get about.
We do. I was in the Julie Andrews suite or room at the Prince Edward Theatre doing the Dear England chaps, who actually got quite a few nominations for the Oliviers, which is really quite thrilling because it was a wonderful play, wasn't it?
It was great. So much so that I decided to change some of the curriculum for my year nines, and I took the play out that we normally do for my group anyway, which is DNA, and I replaced it with Dear England, and they're doing their little performances for me tomorrow. So I'm looking forward to seeing those.
Very nice, very nice. So tell me about For Black Boys Who Have Considered Suicide When the Hue Gets Too Heavy, because it's a wonderful title. It's a very long title, but what's the...
Yeah.
Tell me more about the play.
So this is at the Garrick Theatre. Do you know what? It's quite interesting because I've been to the Garrick quite a lot recently, but everything that I've been to see recently has been kind of somehow related to Shakespeare or the Tudors. So there was the Crown Jewels, there was Horrible Histories, and there was Hamlet. So it kind of is a very, very different piece to see at the Garrick. And this was originally, Royal Court, and this is now Royal Court in the West End. It's by Ryan Calais Cameron, and he's the writer and director. When it was performed at the Royal Court originally, there was the director, Tristan Finn Adekenyu, and, oh my goodness, so this is what I've kind of quoted everywhere, all over the Instagram and Sense PR. Incredibly witty and poignant insight into Black masculinity and vulnerability. It's so beautiful to see a piece like this in a West End theatre. It's great to see this vibrant energy on West End and not just being sort of kept somewhere like Stratford East. You know, it would do incredibly well, but I'm just so thankful that a piece like this is being given the opportunity to spread its wings and come from the Royal Court to here. I went to the after party and actually ended up sitting for an incredibly long time, having a wonderful conversation with Nika Byrne's husband. And we were talking about how it had been to lots of different producers and that she decided to take it on along with Tegan Summer Theatricals and the Hackney Empire and Sarah Vergassi Productions and the Royal Court and to say yes and to put it on at the Garrick. And I think that that's just testament to her kind of foresight and forward thinking. And actually it is pretty much selling out. It's incredible the way that it has sold. The PR mill that's going with, it was Diana that got me you were invited, but you were at the Sister Act event on the same night because we just end up getting all these things at the same time. But it was like Diana at Fourth Wall PR who invited us along. And, oh my goodness, it's set in a group therapy session. The piece, literally the first act went down, and we were looking at each other because it flew by. It went so quickly. And we're all just sitting there thinking, actually, I'm not going to move because I just want the next bit. I just want the next installment. It was the energy in the bar in the interval was incredible. So the cast is made up of six guys. So we've got Toby King Bakare. We've got Shaquille Hakim. We've got Fela Lufadeju, Albert Magashi, and Mohamed Mansoure and Posi Marikinho. Mohamed, I'd seen before in I Love Acting, but F This Industry, F bleep, bleep, bleep. And that was on at Peckham Theatre, which I've spoken about before, which was a play that a friend of mine, Faisal, wrote. Albert Magashi, he was in Dear England, so we saw him in that. Mohamed was also in Barbershop Chronicles years ago that I saw at the National Theatre. And then Posi, he was in Ain't Too Proud. So a lot of these actors I've seen in other things before. And it was really incredible, simple staging, but incredibly effective. And it was the movement direction and the choreography and the sound quality, like the booming bass that would come through while these incredibly proficient movers are on stage with this physical theatre, this movement. They can all clearly dance brilliantly, a bit of crumping in there. And their singing voices were incredible. It was a play, but it had moments of song, acoustic singing, a cappella singing, some accompanied, real changes of energy and tempo from very sad, poignant moments to sort of high impact moments. Just brilliant movement direction and choreography by Theopolis O'Bailey and the musical director and vocal arrangements, John Fumgera. Just really uplifting. So, that you know, there was sad, poignant moments, but equally in the auditorium, there was so much love and it was thought-provoking. It did that thing at the end where it says, if you need to, you know, take a moment to just sit in the auditorium. It'll be open 15 minutes afterwards, which is a new thing that we've noticed over the last 2 years that's been creeping in when a piece is dealing with some hard-hitting issues, but it was really about sort of like, you know, saying what is, saying how things were, saying how things are in Britain, and also saying what could change, what should change. And Ryan, the writer and director, I'll quote him from the programme, he said, "For me, it was about language and Black culture, how Black people express themselves, specifically about how young Black men articulate themselves when words fail them." And it was just energetic, emotional and electric. And in this particular programme, there were so many interviews and interesting articles. It was great. Sometimes you get a programme and you're like, you flick through, you see the, you know, bits and bobs and maybe one kind of historical artifact. But in here, there was lots of interviews about the original production, etc. So I got a lot from it. I really, really enjoyed this. What a great evening. And the after event as well. Caribbean jerk chicken, rum punch. Amazing. Great night.
Great night for you. Yeah, rum punch for me. I do miss actually drinking rum, but as you know, I don't drink alcohol anymore. And as for jerk chicken, well, vegetarian. So hopefully there was something for the sober people and the vegetarians in that after party.
Yeah, there was the plantain. That was great. And then there was some saltfish. So it was all good. And there was DJs. Oh, it was what a night. Brilliant.
I've just checked the website. It is selling incredibly well. Most of the nights are either almost sold out or near to it. But what I love as well, top price ticket is £69.50. And that's really good for West End, even on the performances where it's almost sold out. And you still get £20 tickets. So definitely a piece of theatre that is very accessible even for all theatre goers, I believe.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it's only on for 9 weeks and we're already a week in. So, you know, it's... I would probably go again towards the end. I'd be interesting to see how it evolves and changes if it does. And I had fantastic seats right in the middle, right at the front of the dress circle. But I'd love to watch it from the stalls just to get a different perspective. But I highly recommend this show. 5 stars without a shadow of a doubt. And just loved it. Loved it. So much energy. If I had time in my busy school calendar right now, of which there isn't because there's just a couple of weeks till the Easter holidays, I would without a shadow of doubt take some A-level students to see this because it's something they definitely need to see. But anyway, I'm recommending it to you now if you're listening, my A-level students.
Excellent. Well, I'm going to definitely put it on the list of things to see because I like strong drama. That's one of my things, you know, drama that then leaves you asking, you know, wanting to ask questions about stuff, you know, about your own life, other people's lives and stuff, and encourage conversations. And I think that's what's important about theatre. Otherwise, there's no point, I think. You know, if you go and see something, you go, oh, that was nice. And then you go home and just get on, you know, a bit of CSI on or something. And what's the point? You want to carry the conversation. That's what happened with Blue at Seven Dials Playhouse. It's one of those plays that was so strikingly rich in all its context and in only an hour as well that, you know, me and my friend, we needed to talk about it afterwards and work out what was really going on there and stuff. And that's the important part, I think, of theatre, personally.
Yeah. And I think, and at the after party, there were quite a lot of people that I was, you know, really engaging in quite deep conversations with about some of the topics and the themes, including some of the actors. And I have actually got a couple of interviews lined up with the actors from this one. So I'm really, really looking forward to talking to them about the process of creating, you know, the performance behind the show. And what I like so much is the fact that all 6 actors, the differentiation between their different characters. So they're all incredibly different and they're all going through their own internal struggles. So, it, you know, it's not just the fact that they're Black and that they're looking at that, but they're also looking at what masculinity is to them and what their backgrounds are that they come from. And despite their commonality, they've all come from different Black backgrounds and it explores sexuality as well. So I think that's a really interesting angle to come from. And it's looking at what Blackness is and how that is perceived to people that are other than black. And I find it fascinating. I think it's really, really interesting. And I think it's so incredibly sensitively done so that if you are sat in the audience and you are not black, you can identify with these people and the struggle that they're going through. So it's not, you know, what I'm trying to say is that anyone from any background can watch this play and feel empathy and involved. Really good. Very clever.
Excellent, excellent. Well, moving on from that into a play we actually managed to see together, which is Standing at the Sky's Edge, the transfer from the National Theatre into the Gideon Lynn Theatre in London's West End. Now, again, it's interesting. I'm just flicking through the website and basically having a nose and seeing how it's selling. And it's selling very, very well. But what's interesting is compared to what we just spoke about, top price tickets here is £150. I mean, they still got us, you know, cheaper tickets on a lot of the performances I flipped through, but £150. It's interesting, isn't it?
That's insane. Yeah, it is insane. I mean, I've seen online at the moment those last few random one-off tickets that are dotted about at the Old Vic for just for one day. I've been looking because I really want to see it again, and it closes on the 30th. Those tickets, you know, there's one that's on there for 180, one at 150. And then there's a variety of sort of 99 and 80s, and there's like one for 20, but it's right up at the back, restricted view, can't see, no leg room. Looked at it on seat view and I thought, shall I?
No,
absolutely not.
You might as well just buy the studio recording of the, you know, the cast recording of the album, just sit at home and play that if you're going
to. Well, they haven't, there isn't one yet. So I look forward to that when it does. It should. I would like one. But yeah.
But going on to ticket prices. Now, this is the interesting thing from my point of view. I'm a theatre producer. I'm a commercial theatre producer. I'm not funded. And it is a commercial enterprise. You know, when I was in Germany for the Berlinale, the film festival, a lot of the films were screened in theatres. Now, a lot of their theatres are government-owned. They're owned by the people. So ticket prices that are kept quite low because technically you're paying for the space in your taxes. Now, what happens here is something very different, but I do find it interesting that people will moan about ticket prices, but they're not the ones who are actually like putting on the shows. They don't know what the costs are incurred. But I think as long as there is an opportunity to purchase at semi-decent seats, at least at a reasonable price, I think it's okay. And I think if something's selling, then why not put the prices up? It's more for the people like myself or another show, which we're not going to mention, where you get there too late and the ticket prices are expensive because the reviews are out. People want to see it. There's certain stars that people are really interested in seeing. So, you know, it's an interesting debate, which no one will ever win because the commercial theatre owners will always say ticket prices reflect the commercial value of the piece. And then other people will say, well, you know, what about taking families out and all this kind of stuff? Well, you know, what can you do? What can you say? But I do think there is a lot of cheap tickets going around in theatre. So I do think there's an opportunity for people on lesser budgets to see some really good quality shows. I mean, not being funny, Blue, again, $7 Playhouse, £15. You see a great show for £15.
Yeah, and Charing Cross, you know. Playhouse. Charing Cross Theatre, not Charing Cross Playhouse. Charing Cross Theatre.
Charing Cross Theatre, yeah.
I mean, their show, that's Bronco Billy. That's, and I'm chatting with Taryn Cander next week. Yeah, I mean, they've got great ticket prices on for these shows. But it's interesting, when I was backstage talking on Hadestown, he was saying that, you know, this is the best place in the world for theatre. He said, don't tell my fellow Americans on Broadway. But he said, you know, the ticket prices on Broadway, every ticket is, you're looking at over $100, literally. So to take a family to see a show on Broadway, it costs an absolute fortune. So at least we are lucky to have that variety of different theatres at different ticket market value. You know, there's more opportunities for people to get to theatre. And, you know, there's so many different schemes, sadly not for us, Darren, in our mid to late 40s. But, you know, there are loads of schemes for the under 25s. Lucky them. You know, there's so many schemes with the big theatres like the Barbican, the National, the Young Vic, etc., where they can get a great seat at a great price.
Yeah, no, definitely. But yeah, as you say, what about the middle-aged among us? You know, we want some good deals as well. But we're very fortunate.
Not yet able to draw our pension.
No.
Not yet there.
No, I don't quite tick the pensioner's box yet to buy a ticket. But, you know, one day, if I'm fortunate enough to live that long, you never know. Anyway, let's get back into Standing at the Sky's Edge. Now, this is a music and lyrics by Richard Hawley, and the book is by Chris Bush. It was originally at the National Theatre in 2023, and it's now transferred to Gillian Lynn. And, yeah, it's going really well. I mean, you know, we were there at press night. It's the first time you'd seen it. I'd seen it before when it was at the National Theatre. And I have to say, when I first saw it at the National Theatre, I think it's also because I hadn't seen or really read anything about it before. So I didn't know what to expect. But it was, for me, out of both watching both shows, slightly different cast, but obviously the same piece. When I saw it at the National Theatre, it was much more powerful for me. And I think mainly that was because I didn't know what to expect. I think seeing it again, I knew what was coming, and I'd already felt a certain way emotionally about it. So I knew what was to be expected of me emotionally. Now, you hadn't seen it before, so what was your take on it?
Well, my expectations, was that even a word? My expectations were...
That's a play by, what's his name? The guy who lived in Canterbury. Charles Dickens.
What, my expectations? Oh my God, you mean Great Expectations?
That's the one, yeah.
Well, my expectations were incredibly high. Obviously, you gave it an absolutely glowing review. I've read so many reviews, and I was looking forward to seeing the show for so long, just as I was looking forward to seeing For Black Boys for ages, and the excitement of seeing these two shows in the same week just blew my mind. But I really enjoyed it. I thought the acting was fantastic. The storyline, the concept, the ideas of these lives interweaving. I don't want to say too much because obviously, you know, we don't want to spoil it by telling everyone everything about it. I don't know. I think just my expectations were so high that I just... And I've been spoilt seeing so many amazing shows recently that it was great. I mean, in my eyes, I would say 4-star without a shadow of a doubt. So I'm being super critical, but I think it just seemed like an incredibly large cast, almost unnecessarily so. And I can understand how at the National Theatre, on that stage, that feels just right. Often you see shows in the Olivier and you have a massive ensemble, and that's all part of that beauty of seeing a great production. You know, like House of Bernarda Alba had a big cast, didn't it? Like that opening sequence, we reveal the house and we see all those people in that room at the funeral at the beginning. And it was vast. I mean, the set was imposing. That was incredible. The first thing that you see when you look into the Gillian Lynn Theatre was just this imposing, huge structure. I mean, I have no idea how they managed to get that in there. And it is impressive. That is, without a shadow of a doubt, considering... I mean,
Can we just do a big shout out to Ben Stones then for the set and costume design? Because did you see Sylvia at the Old Vic?
Yes, I did. Yes. Was it him?
He designed that as well.
Yes. Yeah, very different show.
Do you remember that
set? I loved Sylvia. I wish that would come back or travel or do something. That was great. That had real Hamilton vibes. See, look, I'm enthused about that one. But no, I mean, so for me, I think I had a bit of confusion over the choreography because, and so Lynn Page did the choreography, but for me, this linked with some kind of lack of connection that I had with it. And this is similar and on a par to how I felt about Waitress and how I felt about Time Traveler's Wife. So both these shows have got incredible music. We cannot deny that. You listen to the soundtrack and you're singing along and you're blown away. But something about the choreography on stage just doesn't match. For me, it was neither dance nor physical theatre. It was some kind of weird netherworld between the two, a grey area for me, and where I just can't connect with it. And there was just too many of these things. And I just wanted to, the singers were fantastic. The music was beautiful. And for me, it's enough to just watch a singer on stage without bringing on sort of, it felt like 20 other people standing at mics, leaning from side to side or doing some weird arm movements that didn't really add anything to me and actually made me get the giggles a couple of times, which was frustrating because in those moments, they were quite poignant, intimate moments. So for me, I would like to see this production in a much smaller, more intimate theatre, maybe sort of in the round or on three sides, and just really intimate, because the stories that were being told were beautiful. The music was beautiful. The singing was beautiful. The acting was great. But I wanted it to be more enclosed.
I know what you're saying. What's interesting as well is looking at the cast list at the National Theatre, funny enough, there was less cast members. They actually extended it by the looks of it into the West End, which is weird because you think at the National, they're probably, you know, have more people there. But I do know what you're saying. It didn't need so much of an ensemble cast, I don't think. I think it was so powerful for me within its writing and storytelling to focus on the central characters that everything else for me become kind of superfluous. It didn't add value.
No, that's it. Add value. That's the thing. Yeah.
And I think ultimately it's a great piece. I mean, if seeing it at the National Theatre, definitely a 5-star show. Seeing it in the West End, again, I think it's because I've seen it before. It is a 5-star show, but for us, it's a more of a 4-star kind of overall, I think, rating on our rating polls we do.
So am I right in thinking that it was the whole of the same cast, or was it a new cast?
It's a bit of both. There's a lot of new members from the National Theatre version in 2023, a lot of new faces, but some have basically come back. So Rachel Woodin has come back, who played Rose, and Nicola Sloan, who played Vivian, and Samuel Jordan, who played Jimmy. I think they're the kind of standout ones. I do think there's some of the people have come back.
Yeah.
But there are some new members, definitely.
I mean, the cast was incredible, and so many of these people I've seen before. So Joy was played by Elizabeth Ayodele, and I saw her recently at the National Theatre in Small Island. Joel, you've mentioned before, he was in Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime a while back. And then Poppy.
He was in Cock. He replaced Taron in Cock.
Oh, okay. So that's why I really recognise him. Yeah, he was fantastic. I loved that play. That was so good. And then Poppy was played by Laura Pilford. And she was in Flowers for Mrs. Harris, which you saw. Which I didn't get to.
That's right, yep, at the Riverside Studios.
But I've seen her in other stuff before, like falsettos and...
The original Poppy was Alex Young, who didn't come into the West End. So Laura took over that role.
Mm. And then Lauren Redding, who plays Nikki, she was in The Secret Diary of Adrian Mole, 13 and three quarters, which I'm currently directing with my students. So I really remember that because I've been sort of playing that back in my mind a lot recently. But yeah, I mean, it's an incredibly talented cast. I just think all that extra ensemble, and this is no reflection on all the people who are in the ensemble. They all do a brilliant job, but they are just there. And there was a moment of the choreography. There was one standout member of the ensemble, and it was like she got it. It's like she understood whatever Lynn Page's concept was, and she was giving it some welly, wasn't she? We noticed her, but not everyone else was matching that, and the ensemble are not all dancers, definitely not, and you can tell that. And so they've not quite they might be great singers, you know, enhancing the sound, but I don't know, just didn't connect on that side of things. But but the singing's beautiful. I'll be listening to the album as and when they record it.
No, absolutely. Now, the singing and the performances were definitely spot on and definitely worth seeing just for that, if anything else. But yeah, definitely recommended by us, I think.
Brilliant. And then you went off interviewing. Who did you interview this time?
So yes, there's a new play opening on the 21st of March at the King's Head Theatre. It's written by Barry McStay and it's directed by Tom Radcliffe and it's called Breeding. And it's ultimately about two gay guys that want a child. And I will let the boys tell you more about it.
I'm Barry McStay and you're listening to Theatre Audience Podcast.
So I'm sitting in what looks like a closet at the side of a rehearsal space in a lovely church in southeast London with writer Barry McStay and director Tom Radcliffe for a re-emergence, I guess we want to call it, of Breeding, which is going to the new space at the King's Head Theatre after having a successful run last year at the old King's Head Theatre.
That's right.
So what's it like going back into this theatre in a new space?
Well, Tom is new director, but programmed it at the old King's Head as part of his guest artistic director term. And obviously the King's Head's about doubled in size and gained fewer holes in the ground and nice dressing rooms at a beautiful new theatre space. I was in it the other night and it's so shiny and new and lovely, and it's very exciting to be thinking about how the story, which worked in a space half the size and, you know, lower ceiling and pub theatre, is now going to scale up to a newer, brand new 200-seater space, and how the story can scale up and the set can stay at scale up and try and reach more people with it as well.
So what are the main changes that's happened there? You say scale up, well, I mean, besides the set, I'm guessing, what else?
Well, I mean, I guess it's a new production team. So I have been on board for a couple of months now.
Yeah.
And we have an absolutely wonderful creative team. So Ruby Law, who is doing our set design, and Rachel Sumpley, who's doing lighting, and Jack Cooper, who's also doing sound, which is amazing. So the whole production surrounding it, I guess the vision is different. And also dramaturgically, you've done a couple of things.
Yeah. We talked about wanting the play to, first of all, the design stuff, to make the audience feel very drawn into the piece, to be immersed in the world of the play a little bit, rather than coming into a theatre space and feeling like the set is just existing in the theatre, that they enter the world of the play. And then secondly, there were a few moments that we felt that a new run would give us a chance to explore. So there's a couple of new scenes, some scenes have been reordered. We tried to clarify some plot lines, make sure it bring out some themes more strongly. So yeah, it's gained maybe 10 minutes. And like Tom said, a whole new team and a new actor, Emma DeMay, joining us as Beth. And then there's nice that there's some continuity as well. One of the producers was the original producer, the King's Head, obviously, new space, but the same team there who are all very passionate about it. And myself and Dan Nicholson are playing the characters of Zeb and Owen still as well. So there's a nice through line, but a sense of new ideas and new inspirations as well.
So going back to you as a writer and actor, did you write this play specifically for you, or you just happened to think, I can do this role? Or did Tom go, you know what, I think you need to be in this? Or I mean, was it a package deal here? Like, you know, Tom, you can direct this, but I have to be in it.
So when I set out, right, so I trained as an actor, and then when I started writing, my first play was on in 2015. And I had a couple since then before Breeding came along, and I kind of deliberately chose to not be in any of my writing early on, even though I conceivably could have been in a couple of those plays, because I thought it was just good to learn from the outside, make sure I was focusing on that side of it. But when it came to writing the play that became Breeding, I definitely had half an eye on thinking, that's definitely a character I could play. And then, I mean, I started writing it in about 2016. So by the time it came around to being introduced in 2023, I was like, okay, I think I've honed my craft as a writer enough that I should, you know, if I can't play this role while also having my writer hat on, then I won't try it again. But thankfully, it went fairly well last year. And then Tom, when he came on board, didn't ask me to not be in it. So,
yeah, I was very happy. I thought Barry did an amazing job last time. So why, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
And also this time round, the script is much more settled, which is actually quite nice. Last year, we were still working on the script a lot through into previews even. Which was great and gave a really strong foundation for the new draft and the stuff that we've done now. So there's much less trying to tweak writing in the rehearsal room, so I can just wear one actor hat in the room.
Yeah, we did a lot of any dramaturgy questions that we had, we did prior to coming into the rehearsal room.
Tom, you're kind of history with the King's Head has been going on for quite a while now.
Tell
us a bit more about that.
Yeah, so I mean, I have too many hats. Need to put some of the hats away. But
you are the King's Head.
I initially was in
Queens.
I initially, my first time I went to the King's Head was as an actor. So I trained as an actor. And I was in Five Guys Chilling in the last cast that they had there in May 2016. Yeah, it was 2017. And then I had a bit of a break from the King's Head for a while. And then I brought my play Fame Whore to the King's Head in October. Which was the first time I actually directed as well. Then I was asked to be one of the guest artistic directors of the King's Head last year. So my season, A Queer Interrogation, I programmed Brooding as the headline show, which was incredible. And I think we managed to get, I can't even remember now, something like over 30 shows into the space in 4 weeks, which was amazing. And a lot of the work that I did when I was at Wildcard, like a lot of artist development, like, fed into that as well. So that was something that was really nice. And then I'm back. I'm back now. I've been asked to be back this time as a director on Brooding. So the King's Head can't quite get rid of me yet.
Yeah. When Matthew Iliff wasn't available to return because he directed the original run, the suggestion of Tom came and it was like immediately a yes, because obviously he's got that connection to the theatre, but also knows me, loved the play and programmed it initially. We have a friendship that goes back 5 or 6 years as well, so there were lots of shortcuts that it allowed us to take in a way, which has been great. And obviously as an actor and a director and a writer and a producer, he knows all the sides of the industry and the production, so he's very, very empathetic person to work with.
Yeah, I feel like I understand everyone's pain, so I have a lot of patience.
Which you need to have with all those hats on, definitely.
Yeah.
But what within your careers, I mean, writer and stroke actors, mm-hmm. I mean, why is that, do you think? What is that about, that wearing those two hats, that kind of like really inspires you to continue in this work? I mean, would you rather be just one or the other, or are you quite happy kind of like playing multiple roles? Just for you, Tom, because you are doing quite a lot of different things. So
I feel like
I was always a writer throughout when I was at drama school, so you know, I'd written and taken plays to Fringe before I was even at, they were terrible, but before I was even at drama school. And like, I wanted to be an author when I was a child, but before I wanted to be a vet, and then I saw my cat get put down and I was like, no. So,
there's a story there.
There's a story there. But
curious instance of a cat in the night. Oh, no.
I was getting mentoring from Ricky Beadle Blair before, you know, while I was training as an actor, and I immediately came out the gates from drama school trying to get Circa on straight away. So I, like Barry, at first didn't put myself in Circa, even though I very conceivably could have been in that, because I wanted people to take me seriously as a writer. And I used to have such a hang up about how people saw me, and really cared about, you know, what people placed me, because people don't like you to be more than one thing. However, as time has gone on, if I can say this on this podcast, I just don't give a, I do not care. As time has gone on, I just don't care what people think anymore. I just do what I do. And I've had quite a lot of plays produced now. I've ended up producing a lot of them myself because I wanted to get them on, and that was how I, you know, essentially fleshed out those skills. I still act in other people's work as well, because I'm trained as an actor, and now people ask me to direct, and that is lovely. So yeah, I guess I don't need what I do to be informed by anyone else's perception.
Fair enough.
Well, yeah, I bit like different, slightly differently to Tom. I was always writing when I was younger. I'd write short stories, I'd write poetry and stuff, and then when I trained as an actor, I kind of didn't do an awful lot. I started writing a really bad play in drama school. I'm very glad I didn't finish it. Gave it a few years. But I think that, like, I'm always interested in stories, and if that story isn't being told, then I always, like, if it hasn't been told, or if it's in me, I want to tell it somehow or other. And so I finished writing my first play in, like, 2014, and just sent it to, like, everybody. So, like, the Royal Court and the National and the Abbey in Dublin, because we didn't know what to do with any of it. And thankfully, people at the Abbey read it. They had a meeting with me, and it was a workshop, and then the director of that workshop ended up producing it and putting it on. And that did very well, got some attention of reviewers and other directors and an agent and that, and sort of accidentally found more impetus to keep doing that. And then getting to a point where I'm like, okay, I could maybe be in this stuff now as well. I feel like I've got a handle on that. It's quite nice. And actually, I have found as an artist, being affirmed for one aspect of my art, my writing, has made me more confident as an actor as well. And I've always said that being trained as an actor, I think my thing that I do well, the thing I think I do best as a writer anyway, is writing good dialogue, because I try and write dialogue that is very playable and actors would want to play and deliver. And so now getting to play that dialogue that I think is very playable is quite nice. And I think is sort of informing each other now that I know how to approach dialogue and text and scenes better because I've been a writer. So I think actually having those two hats can be useful. We've all gone to a show where you've seen someone has written, directed, produced, done the lighting, design, everything, and sometimes your heart sinks. But
yeah,
that doesn't necessarily mean that they're not very capable. People are, you know, if people are creative, there's a reason we're doing this. And if it's a story they're passionate about, then...
I also think there's a difference between doing, too much on one project and being able to successfully, like, execute multiple roles. Because, you know, as much as I have, you know, worked as a producer, I've worked as a writer, I've worked as an actor, and I've worked now as a director, I like, the best thing about theatre is creating theatre with other people. You need other minds in the room to it's a collaboration, especially being a director. It's about, so much of it is about getting the best out of other people. It's about getting the best of your team cohesively.
And that's the nice thing about coming back to Breeding, actually, has been having a new director and a new design team, and they've all come in with brilliant and completely valid approaches to the story, which are not like how we did it the first time round. And that in turn inspires me to think about the character differently or bits of writing differently. So it is, like you say, getting the best thing isn't what you're doing, it's getting other people in the room who also buy into the idea of the story, what you're doing, and then, you know, cohesively and as a group, making it as good as it possibly can be.
That's why the term make theatre comes about, because you're right, you can't do it by yourself, although some people do. You probably wear too many hats and they do it quite badly. I mean, you know, we could probably between us come up with quite a few examples. And some people just need to be told no.
Thankfully, we keep being told yes.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about the play. I mean, you know, what audience is going to, can't even say the word audience, audience is going to expect from seeing Breeding.
So Breeding is a dark romantic comedy about a couple, Zeb and Owen, who are a gay couple. They want to adopt a kid, and it's their journey through the adoption process with their social worker, Beth. And the audience will discover through the course of the play that all three of these characters have met each other, if you like, at a very important moment in all of their lives. And secrets about themselves and each other and their past and their presence and their futures begin to emerge. And hopefully, I think audiences will come in and maybe find themselves thinking it's one thing when it begins and be surprised by what it is by the end. And it's funny and it's moving and it's zippy and it's a very contemporary story. I essentially wanted to take a subject that is very much the domain of heterosexual people in art. You know, wanting a kid is very much usually man and woman, in whatever way they try and approach that. So taking that and queering that was very much what I wanted to do, because, you know, we've, very importantly, the queer theatre canon has, you know, AIDS plays and coming out plays and chemsex plays and non-monogamy plays. And now, you know, we've, certainly in this country, thankfully, we've won a lot of rights. And what do we do with these rights? What are the next stories that are being told that haven't been represented before necessarily on stage?
Daddies.
Daddies, yes. Fun daddies and serious daddies. That's the
characters I'd
say. Yeah. So, but I don't want audiences to think it's just a gay play, because these stories are happening all over the country and people of all orientations need to see these stories, and people need to see themselves being represented, but also see the people around them being represented. And, you know, a lot of the themes in the story, I think, are very universal. I think audience members, certainly when they came before, found bits of everything that connected with them. So, yeah, I think they will be entertained. I think they'll laugh. Hopefully they'll cry, and hopefully they will be glad they spent the 70, 75 minutes with these characters.
Yeah, I think as it furthers the narrative of, I guess, the stories that we're telling from a queer lens at the moment. I think it's, you know, as Barry's already pointed out, I'm not going to repeat exactly what you just said, but it's just furthering the conversation to reflect kind of issues that are more present to society now. And I think it is really funny and it is really hopeful and it will be emotional. But I do think that ultimately the audience will leave with a lot of hope and also just a thoroughly entertaining night at the theatre as well.
Like, having looked at the design and the plans on that front and now working with the actors again and working with Tom, I'm just so, like, the number of amazing people who are putting amazing work into this is so thrilling for me. Like, I'm not sitting here just saying the play I've written is brilliant. All the production that everyone is putting together is going to be, I think, people are going to be really impressed by what we can do in the King's Head space.
I think so. I hope so. If, you know, pull it together.
If we all do it right. Yeah.
If we do it well. And I feel like eyes are on me at that moment. But I generally do. I have this team are amazing. And I'm very blessed that we have the team we do. And I'm really excited to see it in space. I think that it's, well, to date, given that they've, you know, it's brand new theatre, it's going to be really exciting to see what the new King's Head can become in terms of how you can be ambitious with your design, how you can, like, push it forward from...
Yeah, and tell these big stories in those spaces.
Absolutely.
And at the King's Head, this is the third main show in the new space.
This will be the third main show, and the first in Thrust.
Yeah, the Thrust orientation. They're very excited about that. But yes. Yeah, the excitement from the theatre as well is really, like, and they say themselves, they felt it's important to, in this new space, to have a show that was in the old space, sort of, if you like, carry on through into the new, bigger space, to show that theatrical lineage in the old pub theatre is still carrying on, even though they've moved to a shiny new theatre.
Excellent. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing it finally. Sorry I missed it the first time around, but no, it sounds exciting. It will be the first show I see in the new space, so that'll be really exciting. Have I seen the space?
The space.
No, I haven't. I've not been there. It's very
exciting. I think it still has a really clear identity, which is nice. Obviously a different identity, but it doesn't, you know, it's a new space, but it really feels so individual, which is really nice.
Yeah. There's not another space like it. But also with an amazing facility for theatre in it.
Excellent. Okay. So Breeding is on from when?
21st of March is our first show, and we run until the 14th of April. The dates and times vary slightly, so just visit King's Head's website for all of the details.
Why not grab a ticket to one of the shows mentioned in this podcast? Tune in next time and recommend us to your friends and family.
Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Theatre Audience Podcast and on Twitter at Theatre Audie Pod. Until the next time, goodbye and thank you for listening.